I want to thank you all for coming tonight. We'd like to spend an hour together conversing about a subject that, quite frankly, is very interesting to me. I have actually become more interested in it because I have a son who is involved in the film industry, and so every time we converse with one another, the subject is largely about film and what's going on, and he keeps me abreast of John Johnson's activities. So tonight, we'd like to ask our panel here first to address the question, when have you experienced the sacred in film, and what is sacred for you? That's our theme this summer, listening to the sacred, and we've been pushing around that image a good bit throughout the summer days. Our panel tonight is Elaine Wagner, who is a film critic and a writer for a variety of publications. Ruth Frost, who is a Lutheran pastor in San Francisco, and John Wagner, who is...
John Johnson.
John Wagner. Well, John is many things. He's a producer, and I don't even know quite how would you describe yourself, John?
Well, we thought we would kind of tell
you would him. Tell what you do, but he's been involved in the film industry for many years now. And has actually a very interesting job, so we'll let John tell you a little bit about that. So perhaps each of you could begin with Elaine, and one of my jobs is to be the timekeeper and ask each person to say a bit, and then we'd like to open it up for conversation. We'll try to end at 10 o'clock, and then if you'd like to continue on conversing about this subject, which I think is not only fascinating, but very interesting from the standpoint of what film could do to reach our culture and our nation. I don't think we've begun as a nation to really think about its possibilities. We've had largely a market approach to it. Whatever we'll sell, we'll produce. But to really begin to think about it as an art form would be interesting for us as a culture. So, Elaine, why don't... Or maybe you had an order
we
that you wanted.
We kind of did.
Did you have an order?
No. Oh, I can start.
You want John to start here?
All right.
Great.
I'm John Johnson, and I've worked in television and motion pictures for about 13 years. I graduated from the University of Wisconsin in the film and television program there in 1979. I was a television producer for Cairo Television, Channel 7 in Seattle for about 8.5 years. And I worked for a Japanese motion picture studio, actually two studios, for the last 4.5 years in Los Angeles. And I now live in Los Angeles. One of my big interests right now is writing scripts that somehow include the sacred in a wide sense so that the world could recognize universal themes. And I'm not interested in making narrow audience films for like training films for Lutheran Brotherhood or something. I'm interested in including the sacred in my scripts that I want to appeal to a mainstream audience. Some of the things that I've been doing in the past is recently is buying films, American films, for distribution in Japan, and bringing Japanese films to America. And some of those, the most famous American picture that I've acquired for Japan is called The Player. And the most famous film that we're bringing to America right now is Akira Kurosawa's most recent film called Mata Dayo. And I'm negotiating the distribution in America for that now. And Kurosawa is probably Japan's most famous movie director. We also have made a few small pictures. the idea is to find a young director out of a film school and give them $250,000 and have them make their first feature film. And we did six of those around the world. I was responsible for the Los Angeles area, and I found two directors there. We completed two films for $250,000 each, which is very cheap, if you know what movie budgets are. I think the average mainstream movie budget now is $27 million.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. So these kids made it for $250,000 and conned all their friends, and anybody, all the equipment they got for, you know, however they could do it. And we were very happy because they both turned out great, and one of them won the Sundance Film Festival Grand Prize last year in January. It's called Public Access. So that made me look good, even though I didn't know what I was doing at the time. I thought these kids look talented, you know, take them. And one of them ended up winning the Sundance Film Festival. So that's kind of my activity right now. And besides that, I am writing scripts. I'm here for selfish reasons, because I want to know what you think could be included in a motion picture that would speak to the sacred.
John, can you say a little bit more about what is the sacred for you?
One of the things we could do all together tonight is talk about what motion pictures for us have touched us deeper than a few yucks or a couple tears, something that really went a little deeper. And a film for me that did that was called Field of Dreams. And for some, they didn't buy it because it was kind of a convoluted premise. But if you kind of went along with the story, this man that tears down his cornfield to build a baseball field so ghosts of baseball greats could come back and play there. I remember being very moved by that film and having it work on me on many different levels. And at the end, sort of crying and not usually crying at films, the lights came up and everyone's leaving, and I'm kind of, you know, trying to, you know, get a grip on it. And that's what I want to do to people around the world. I want to bring them that kind of experience, and something that is not just used once, but over and over again, and years later, people would watch that and find something of themselves in it, and find something meaningful that they can use in their lives. Sacred to me is many things. In these scripts I'm writing, though, I'm trying to use. Scotch is very knowledgeable about Jung and dreams. And motion pictures for me are dreams, and they enter our subconscious and our conscious in ways much deeper than other things. Because when we're in that theater, in that dark theater, we're having a kind of a communal dream. And I think it goes right in. And we'll talk a little bit about that, about what that means and how that affects our lives. And I think films are very influential and have a great effect on our lives. So I want to do something that has an impact on people's lives, and not. I think a lot of times people say, "Well, that's the movies, and it's just the movies." And like my grandma, why do you want to be in that? You know, why do you want to be in showbiz? And because I don't feel like giving it up to the bad people and letting them the sleaze bags and letting them control the most influential form of communication in the world. And we're not just talking about America. Right now, American pictures are the motion pictures that are seen most by the world. It's not just the U.S. anymore. Hollywood's always talking about a global business. It's a very global business. And whatever we make down the street here in L.A. or in Seattle gets seen by 70 countries. Basically, there's 70 major motion picture territories around the world. And they buy it. And they come to L.A. every year in February, and they buy it. It's called American Film Market. and the movies they make in Europe and everything, they're beautiful, and many of them are enjoyed in Europe, and some breakthrough, maybe My Left Foot, My Life as a Dog, Cinema Paradiso, but the other hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them are seen just in France or just in Germany. Hmm. And so the movies we're making here in America have a great impact all around the world, and I think we shouldn't give up that power. I think we should do something with it. So that's why I'm here, to find out what you think, what I should write, what I should include in those scripts I'm working on.
That's really true. You know, we've lived overseas twice, once in Switzerland and once in Norway. And by far the majority of films that were advertised and people saw in Switzerland and Norway were American films in English, as opposed to European films or films from other parts of the country. So we're exporting whatever American films are all about, largely to the rest of the world.
I was just going to ask, one movie that you might have seen that my company has done is called My Neighbor Totoro. It was out in May and June and on the West Coast and in New York. How many are from New York, L.A., Seattle, or San Francisco? That area. Well, that movie was for kids. And
what was the name of it again?
My Neighbor Totoro. It's an animated picture. Made about $400 million in Japan. Very popular. Yeah. And so it's by a man that's like the Disney in Japan, and they're very nice, wonderful films for kids and families. So that's part of my job now, is to try to bring those films to America. And they're all redone in English. And so I'm done.
Okay. Well, I have absolutely no professional background in film whatsoever. I just happen to be kind of a movie buff. And like John, I'm very interested in how movies can be the purveyor of spirituality. And I'm interested in the power of movies to shape or misshape human life. And so when I think about what is sacred, what's the sacred in film, oh, geez, that's awfully hard to describe. But I guess for me, the sacred has to do with what is life-affirming rather than what's death-dealing. What enables us to say yes to life, yes to the whole range of human experience, which may include a great deal of suffering as well. And the sacred for me is also what promotes justice, love in society, and a sense of our interconnectedness. So spirituality for me has to do with what enhances my sense of worth, belonging, and connection to others and to creation. When I think of my experience of the sacred in, you know, a particular film, it would be hard to limit it to just a few films. We've brought along some films this week that have spoken to me in some powerful ways. One is Jesus of Montreal, which is a Canadian film which sets the life of Christ in the 20th century, retells it for the 20th century. And it's very powerful in its simplicity. And that film moves me in ways I haven't been moved in a long time seeing a movie. Another movie that has moved me a great deal lately is a movie called Leaving Normal, which was directed by Sidney Pollack. It came out about the same time as Thelma and Louise did, and it was compared to Thelma and Louise, and superficially it's similar in that it involves two women who meet one another and go for a trip together. But the comparison kind of ends there. And I think what is powerful for me in that film is that it's about the choices that people make and the events that choose them. And it's also about the opportunities that ordinary people have for extraordinary acts of decency and actions that can further our connection to one another in the world or further disconnection. And it's also about creating the bonds of family based not on biology, but on love. And so you get some interesting alternative family that develops in that film. And I don't want to tell you too much about the film because we're going to show it Wednesday. So that was a movie that spoke to me powerfully. And then, of course, there are movies that just confront us with the constant temptations for the use and abuse of power and the exploitation of our brothers and sisters and of our physical environment. And some of those are a movie that is very powerful that way is The Field, which is about power and possession. And that's another movie that we're going to be showing up here. One of the things that I'm concerned about with respect to movies, and we'll pursue this a little bit more later, but is this business of the film as having the power to shape or misshape human life and having the power to norm reality, to norm and define reality. And that raises the question for me, who norms and defines reality as mediated through film? As a woman and as a lesbian, I certainly have had to see lots of films that are norming a reality that I don't directly experience at first hand, and that I have to experience in sort of a translation process. And I think an awful lot of people of color, people who are marginalized economically, women, gay and lesbian people, experience this. When, as I grew up, as a child and as an adolescent, I didn't see a single movie that provided me with any positive role models for my lesbian identity. I mean, there was nothing. That was true also of the reading material that was available to me. It wasn't until I was in my 30s that I saw my first film with lesbian characters in it. And one of the things that meant was that when I looked at films as a young person growing up, I had to actually leave my body and enter into male bodies in order to experience emotional, sexual, romantic intimacy with women. I mean, thinking now of films that convey themes of love and intimacy, because I never saw anything dealing with two women's intimacy with one another, or even two men's intimacy with one another. And that kind of splitting off that gay and lesbian people have to do when they watch films that are entirely heterosexual models is very detrimental. So that's a concern that I bring into this discussion on film tonight, is who norms reality through the medium of film, and who gets left out in that process, as movies tend to churn out, as a lot of Hollywood movies anyway tend to churn out so-called mainstream culture that may leave out a lot of people. So hopefully we can talk some more with you about that.
My pen name is Lynn Lawrence. I've been writing since 1987, movie reviews. I wrote first for one Lutheran newsletter and two Methodist newsletters. Then I wrote for the Yelm, Washington newspaper. And now I have organized a multicultural reviewing team writing for the Northwest Dispatch in Tacoma, which is published 5 days a week. I'm trying to develop a new concept in movie reviewing, two new concepts actually, one that's relatively new, and that is talking about values in movies. Most reviewers are more interested in pontificating and rating the movies, and also telling about the plot. These are not really my areas of interest, although I will touch on them. There are quite a few of us that in this team that are writing for this newspaper. There are two writers, myself and another person, and there are several who collaborate with me, and including my school children. Writing is a secondary occupation at this time. I hope it will be primary in a couple of years. I'd like to break through the glass ceiling that is so evident for many females in different occupations. Concerning a movie which had a lot of spirituality, for me there was a movie that was not overly spiritual and yet had tremendous amount of power. And there have been a lot of them, but this one I think has really been swimming around in my head lately, and that was Dead Poets Society. How many of you saw Dead Poets Society? Aha, a lot. You can probably remember then the speech in which Robin Williams is taking his new recruits through the hall, the entry hall there at the boys' school, and he's showing the pictures of the former classmates, a lot of whom have died, and it's his Carpe Diem speech. And I tape recorded that because it had so much power for me, and I listen to it and look at the words. And there are even Carpe Diem t-shirts that you can buy from a certain outlet in Minnesota. Garrison Keillor's Minnesota Public Radio, which he originally started with. You're probably more familiar with that than I am.
Carpe Diem means?
Yes, Carpe Diem means seize the moment, seize the day. And make the most of your life that you can. And he talks about those people, many of them in the picture are pushing up daisies. And he exhorts his new recruits to seize the moment and to make their dreams come true. And I'd like to hear some of the movies or you people that you feel have spiritual qualities too, which are overtly spiritual or have power for you.
Before we open it to the group here, you know, there seems to be a formula in Hollywood about movies. You have to have a chase, you know. You have to have a romance. A lot of movies feel they've got to have a lot of TNA in them to make it go. I mean, there seems to be sort of, you know, you could take these things and every movie seems to be what. I mean, do you think we can break out of that? Is there and yet on the other hand, some of these some of the great epic films and some of the great films do really seem to take off. But yet, you know, film after film after film is kind of just a rerun of this kind of stuff. There's a violence. Why is that? I mean, why are we sort of stuck with that kind of stuff?
It sells tickets. I asked a producer who's been making movies, lots of movies for 20 years, looking for some great insight on how to make movies that appeal to people. I said, Lloyd, what do you do? What can you do? Do you have any kind of formula or any kind of system for making sure that when you produce your film that you will always get a big enough audience to justify the cost, because movies are expensive? You know, what do you do to make sure that you can get the money back and make the next picture? And he said, if you put guns in it, people will always come.
Okay. That's what he said.
That's what he said.
Put guns in the people's hands.
And I said, and I was just waiting for something else, and that's what he, that was it. If you put guns in it, people will all show up.
What do you think, Elaine? You're a critic. I mean, why?
Oh, I think the bottom line, they have this concept of what's going to make money, and it doesn't always make money, but it's governed by the what they think will sell. And sometimes a movie can be going along about 99% of the movie could be one rating, and then you get this little blip that is definitely out of character. And I have read and heard that they just insert this to bring the rating down, because a G rating or a PG is almost like the kiss of death for a lot of films. And so one of the things they do to try to sell more movies is to include something which is more violent or more sensual. And when I write movie reviews, I say this is a time to go get some popcorn or take your kids to go get popcorn. If you're going to see the movie, avoid this part.
One ironic thing in Hollywood now is that 70% of motion pictures, approximately 70%, are rated R.
Yeah.
But 70% of the money that movies have been making lately come from PG-13 and PG.
Is that
from the minority of films that are made.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I just read that it was something like 6 out of the top 7 top grossing movies was either G or PG. I mean, with Aladdin and
Home Alone,
and I don't know what they were, but it was very shocking to me that this actually was true.
Yeah, they make a ton of money.
The one reason they said was because you've got, in an R, you've got the parents going. In a G, you've got the kids going, but the parents usually have to go with them, so you've got that audience whether they want to see it or not. So you've got, you're selling 2 tickets where you'd only be selling one and the other one.
Okay.
I know that PG-13s are usually much more, I don't want to use the word sexist, and I think that they don't have the violence in it, but they certainly have everything else.
And wouldn't it be interesting if we did ratings that were, it took into consideration whether a film was really racist, or whether a film was really sexist, or a film was really heterosexist? I mean, how the ratings are interesting, because sometimes ratings are based strictly on the amount of nudity in a film. That's not going to bother me nearly as much as the conflation, for example, of violence as a chaser to sex. You know, in other words, is the conflation of violence and sex, or how racist a film is, or how sexist a film is, how violent it is to women or to people of color, or to, you know, I mean, it's, I wish we had ratings, you know, that could, well, I don't know if I wish we did, but I wish ratings included some of those notions.
One thing I didn't say that I think I can say the most clearly is the man who thought that guns sell. That's sort of an easy shorthand for making a picture and just tell the director to throw some guns in there. But one thing I really believe is that the sacred sells. I think that when you look at America or the world, most people have a spiritual belief. In America, I think more than 80% say they believe in God. But motion pictures, for the most part, leave it out. And for me, that's like leaving out eating. Like, people never show people eating. Well, people in movies are eating all the time, but you never see them any kind of awareness of God or any kind of awareness of the sacred or belief
in
God.
They use his name a lot.
Yeah. But the really good movies, I think, reach in and do that, go deep in like that, like Field of Dreams or the highly successful Star Wars. And Field of Dreams is also very successful, and I think the sacred sells. I don't know why, but they're afraid of it, or they don't know how to approach it. And
I was thinking of Steven Spielberg, who's produced a lot of children and adult movies that have brought in a ton of money. And Bill Moyers, I mean Joseph Campbell, didn't talk about some of the motifs in the Star Wars trilogy and that as being Saber.
There was a load of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of stuff in there that was interesting.
Lots of metaphors and...
Yeah, over here.
I've heard that film industry movies, that they're in real trouble and they're geared for the people that are buying the tickets are the teenagers. Is that right?
Well, we were talking about that earlier. It's actually the teenage audience in America, and Elaine doesn't agree with this, but the teenage, according to Motion Picture of America Association statistics, the teenage audience is actually declining in America, and the 30 to 50-year-old audience is growing. The movie audience is getting older, basically.
Does that take into account all the videos that are rented and stuff like that, or is that just people
that's
that
just
go out,
theatrical.
Buy a ticket and go to the...
It's just a theatrical business, the movie theater.
Yeah, okay. Well, where have some of you experienced the sacred in film? I think that would be kind of interesting. Yeah, Joel?
Lately, one that moved me a great deal was like Water for Chocolate.
From Mexico.
Yeah, from Mexico. It was brilliant, I thought. It was beautiful. And there was a wonderful mix of reality and kind of surrealist view and very spiritual, I thought. I would highly recommend it if you get a chance.
Could you say more about the spiritual nature of it anymore?
Specific.
It's hard to define.
Yeah, I mean they. No, I couldn't really.
But you felt it there anyway.
Yeah, it was very moving. And I remember afterwards thinking, I went alone. I didn't have anyone to talk about it, which usually helps relive it. But...
Well, that was a film from Mexico.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know it or not, but we don't watch movies from Mexico, usually, in America. But that one made $11 million in America.
The book was excellent. I just read it.
Like Water for Chocolate, Como Agua para Chocolate.
The spiritual dimension that I saw in it is related, for me, was related to the fact that the lead character's emotional, spiritual longings and yearnings were expressed in the food she prepared for her family. So just maybe a little snippet, I hope it doesn't ruin it for those who are going to see it, but she was forbidden to marry the man she wanted to marry. So, but she helped make the wedding cake, and her own tears dripped into the cake batter. And as everyone ate the cake, they all started crying. And then they got sick, of course. But I mean, it was so powerfully poetic. And then there were several other things along the way, but it was connected with food and emotion.
It had a lot to do with food and
preparing.
And she herself, the main character, was... She was very spiritual and creative because when she was in the womb, a grandmother or something cried in the batter that she fed to the mother. I can't remember exactly, something like that. And then this child was born, and she was the same temperament as the grandmother.
And she was born right on the cooking table.
Yeah, back here, you wanted to say something about this one.
Well, the fact that her desires, she and the male lead, their desires were not fulfilled. I mean, like people in American movies, oh, you see somebody you like, and right away you jump into bed, and they know that suspense of not fulfilling every desire, of having to abstain.
I just want to ask a question. You're talking about these films that we, in a city of 100,000, the capital city of Oregon, don't have any access to, and I suspect that makes up maybe 95% of the room. The only thing we see is the major things that come out of Hollywood. How do you, we have to live with what we're given.
You should move to D.C.
I don't want to move.
I guess video stores.
But they don't carry anything. They just carry the,
Well, eventually, don't they? Most of these get in the video?
Not in Salem, they don't.
Maybe not in Salem.
Different stores are more or less responsive to their audience. Can request video stores, and sometimes they will.
But this one was a huge hit, so they might.
It was shown in Tacoma.
Yeah.
They saw it in Tacoma.
Okay, where else in film do some of you see sacred coming up?
Yeah.
There's a German film that I found on VCR called Wings of Desire. Mm-hmm. And Vendors.
Yes.
And It's an amazing film because it's about...
I hope somebody's making a list here.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
It's about angels. And at the beginning of the film, you see these, it's in black and white, and you see these angels walking around the earth looking at humans, you know, and every now and then, well, humans can't see them, but they'll just sit down and they'll just sort of sense, you know, something around them. And then in about a third of the way into the film, one of the angels longs to become human, and the fallen angel becomes human, and the film shifts to being in color. And there's this wonderful scene where this angel becomes human, is walking, he's set in Berlin, and he goes up to a coffee stand and buys a cup of hot, steaming coffee. And he's just like, and he asks the person, is this coffee? and is this heat? Because the angels can't feel anything. They're not, they have intelligence, but they don't have sensuous bodies. And it's a film in which you see this angel discovering as an adult what it is to feel, you know, he's walking around, so suddenly feels cold. And it's like he doesn't know whether, but the cold feels so good, he never felt cold before. And it's a film that just allows you suddenly to sort of see your embodied physical existence as precious. It's a very, you know, life-affirming, incarnational, if you want to use Christian language, film.
Did the angel also feel a sense of pain, emotional pain? As
yeah,
well?
He learns to, yeah, the angel can't feel pain, but when he becomes human, he falls in love, and there's, you know, it's just, it's a wonderful film.
Wings
of Desire.
It's interesting because as I listen to people talk about this, what is coming up as sacred is the sensual, and food keeps it, that's why I love the best feast.
The best feast.
You know, it's all around food, and that's kind of
yeah, say more about Babette's. Have you seen Babette's Feast? Yeah, some of you have.
It's a long time ago.
I loved it in Danish, and I didn't understand a word. I first saw it in Norway.
Well, it's beautiful film to watch. It takes place. Is it Denmark? In a very unique and sort of small community of very proper, and very religious folk. But you know.
All they'll ever eat is boiled, anything that can be boiled, which is, you know, coming from the Norwegian tradition, is very and then they, do you remember any?
You can probably
well, see just that. The, one of the, Babette is this woman who's from France, and she was exiled because of the revolution, and she's this amazing cook that used to cook for some crown prince or something, and so she's got this amazing French repertoire of food, and she comes in and does this, and everyone is just almost, you know, they feel like they're sinning, eating something.
They can hardly bring
food. Then it's just, you know, they get this wine, and she brings everything in, and it's wonderfully done.
It's incredibly sensual, and it's all around food, and the preparation of this meal, and these people tasting things they've never tasted before.
Well, experiencing their bodies in a way that they don't have
it
before.
What's coming up with the same thing, I guess, with Wings of Desire. And that is based on Rilke's genealogies very directly.
Well, it also is, you know, what happens to these people around this table, and it's because this feast goes on. It's not just, you know, here the boiled potatoes, eat them and run.
Right.
It goes on all evening, you know, and one course after another, so it's a real ritual. Really, back here.
It's an old one, and I have the video of it. But how about the jazz singer? Have any of you seen that?
Al Jolson?
No, not that far back.
Neil Diamond.
Have any of you seen that one?
Yeah, sure.
That has a meaning, I think.
What struck you about it?
Well, the father and son relationship, and if you only see it for the first time, you never know the very final thing that the Jewish father, you know, is that he married Neil, married the what do you call the
Gentile,
And then Daddy is so upset, you know, he tears the clothes and all, at the very end, the father and son relationship. It's very touching. You learn a lot about the Jewish religion, and it's beautifully done. Alienation and reconciliation. I don't know, it's not spiritual, but do any of you remember it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. I have the video now. You know, it's very meaningful and I think educational. Would you call that spiritual?
Well, I think so, because that's what we're talking, that's what we're kind of asking, is what is sacred to you, and what is sacred to you in motion pictures? And Ruth said relationships, and so did you. And other people said food and communal eating and meals.
But we'll go back here, and then over here, and then,
and then up here.
And then up here.
I walked in late, so I didn't hear a definition of sacred.
Well, you can give us your own.
So that now, knowing that, you know, there are so many options for this, three movies that I like very much: Howard's End, Enchanted April.
What was the first one?
Howard's End.
Howard's End?
And Room with a View. And
Room with a View.
Enchanted April.
Enchanted April.
And is there another one?
That's three.
But is there another in that same genre? Okay. Because the filming is so beautifully done, in my view. A lot of sound and music is exceptional, and the focusing on the flower or the bee or the swish of the dress going through the, as the grass is parted as she walks through. I mean, I'm just gone with that. That's
Maurice is another in that.
Maurice.
Where angels fear to tread.
Didn't you find the message in Howard's End rather dismal? Well, basically it was the same message as in Crimes and Misdemeanors. The good guy ends up dead, and the fellow who is the lesser of the two, the conniver, he ends up not getting his just due in most people's opinion. Didn't that strike you? But it was very poetic.
Yeah. I mean,
it was so poetic that it mollified the message.
But it's a new category of sacred that she brought up, like music and sounds. Sounds. Dresses rustling through wheat.
Well, I think
poignant to me. I work with deaf and hard of hearing, and maybe so I'm really tuned into
so it's
thing.
Sacred to you.
But
another dimension to sacred is the power of a film to transport you out of your own culture and put you into another culture, or put you into someone's shoes that you normally could not ever identify with, that you perhaps have had no experience with. But somehow in that film, you come to some kind of sympathy, some kind of identification, some kind of understanding or appreciation of someone that you would normally have just written off as beyond the realm of your own cultural experience. And I really appreciate films that can do that for me.
When you say
okay,
that,
I'm gonna go back here and then over here and then up here, just to be faithful to those who are kind of saying
them. I think what you were just saying, one of them that really did that much better in the book, actually, in the film, but it was I heard the owl call my name, because it took a completely different culture and was very bleak, and that threw this man into an area that he had no familiarity with, and you just really feel it.
What culture was it?
Is it Native
American?
And I use it in 7th and 8th grade Native American teaching. And the interesting part is we use it in Lakota. Some of them really like it. Some of them are very bored with it.
I think the author's name is Craig. C-R-A-V-E-N.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Carolyn,
do
you want to say?
I was just going to say that, as I said, we only see
the things that Hollywood gives us, and then we usually wait till things come out on video. The only time we go into the theater is if we start talking Academy Awards and then we'll maybe be there to see them. And one that will live with me forever is Rain Man.
Oh yeah.
That is so hard.
What was it about that?
What was it about it?
Yeah, I think that struck a chord pretty nationally.
Well, I guess in part because our son, when he was very young, had some autistic tendencies, and that hit us particularly. But just, there are so many like that, but I think the storyline is so great. The relationships they show are fantastic. They're educational. And they have, to, like the F word, if you could live with the F word every other sentence, it was, you know, that and once, as I recall, was like one sex scene briefly. But if you they could just make them so you could feel comfortable taking children or whatever, everyone could learn and benefit from them.
Well, just again, the first response to this in the same lines, films that expose you, make you, you know, sympathize with other cultures. And for someone up here mentioned, The Crying Game is a good one for, I don't know, I mean, the way that surprise in the middle of how you sympathize with the, I mean, as a homosexual man, and it was just really interesting to relate the way the relationships work. But what I raised my hand for earlier was wondering if anyone thought the same thing about Terry Gilliam, the director. He's only made a couple of movies, but what makes him sacred to me is the moral undertone. I think, like, The Fisher King was his most recent one, I think. Before that, he made a block, well, he spent a lot of money, but lost a lot of money. Some of the adventures of Baron von Munchausen. The whole idea of human imagination and fantasy and the power of the human spirit. And that was just, I don't know if anyone else thought of Terry Gilliam.
Rebecca, you were going to say?
Children of the Lesser God.
Oh, yeah. What was powerful about that?
I think, similar to what was said earlier, the idea of an experience that I, you know, someone unable to hear, and the way that movie addressed sound. You know, things that I had never thought about before. Also, simply, again, physicality of watching signing was gorgeous to me, absolutely beautiful. And I guess that element of sound and humor was in that also, that they did not treat it so carefully, that they, you know, they treated it very carefully, but there's a scene where there's a party going on for all the students at this school couldn't hear, and the music was blaring so that vibrations could be felt, I think, if I'm remembering it correctly. And, you know, for the hearing, we came in, it was phones were ringing and just pandemonium, but it was an interesting perspective of something that I hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
I think going way back in time, one that stuck with me for years and years and years is Lilies of the Field.
Is what?
Sydney Poitier.
Sydney Poitier.
Yeah. One of the most marvelous, refreshing movies that I think I've ever seen, and one that I remembered since the first time I saw it.
I always remember Guess's, what was it, Guess's?
This was
that had a profound effect on me at the end.
Is there any good film, religious? Every film that you like a lot, does that make it religious? I don't know the answer, I'm just curious.
No.
To
you, maybe, yeah. Yeah, good. I'm from Turlock, California. The highest amount, the most churches in the United States are in Turlock. We're also popular for medical art. And
for what? For
medical alert.
Is there a relation between those two?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a good one. The little old lady that jumps, you know. No, she and also becoming the video capital of the world. Every week there's a video some. All these businesses are closing, but these video stores are all over. So my 100%. Pedigree Swedish husband who won't buy me a ticket to a theater, a movie, because it's too expensive, and I don't care because it's all junk to me. We're starting to selectively choose videos. We're going to start really earnestly, and I want a list of all those that you.
We'll print this up.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to get a list of this. I'd like.
I want to say, yeah. John, I'm one that doesn't have a video in my place. I go to the movies.
Three times a week, baby.
Really? Is that right? That's right. Well, what's a special experience?
Why? What?
Why? Yeah. Because you're getting out of your own atmosphere. I like the darkness of the theater. I like just getting dressed and going out and doing something different rather than sit there and chomp on popcorn or whatever.
It's a community experience.
And it you have an experience with the people that are laughing or crying or doing mm-hmm. something else, mm-hmm. right? You know, in your near vicinity. So you're in a more I don't know.
I think there's a real power in that. Because what I do, I sometimes do the opposite of the movie I'm afraid to see or think I don't want to see. I'd rather bring it home because I don't want it to be mm-hmm. completely in front of me. I can remove myself a little bit from
yeah,
well, Field of Dreams was that way for me. I kind of had to escape from that theater. It was like,
I have a real hard time sitting down and watching a video. I don't know why. I can't tell you why that is. I should examine that, I guess. But I do love to go to the theater and watch a movie.
She has a dollar theater
in her place. Oh, is that it?
The sound isn't very good, but you don't.
But what's moved you this last year? What's moved?
I like Sleepless in Seattle.
Why? Why did you like that?
Because it was so real.
And the music was terrific, wasn't it?
Yeah, and this little kid is trying to get a parent, trying to get the mother back that's dead. I mean, it's so funny. I cried.
Who thinks of bad Jimmy putting Jimmy Durante on that soundtrack? It was great.
And Prince of Tides is another one that I really
like. I like that, Prince of Tides.
I like that too. You were talking about the F word before. One of the funniest
Does that mean
best
fart?
That we ever saw was See No Evil, Hear No Evil. And yet we had some church friends, quote, that walked out before it ever really got going because they just absolutely couldn't stand the language.
And what movie
and
was it?
See No Evil, Hear No Evil.
About how many years
one
ago was that?
One guy was blind, one guy was deaf.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the funniest, best movies I've ever seen.
But when was that released?
One can see the legs of a woman and the other one can smell her.
Yeah. Is this Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder?
When was this?
2-3 years ago.
It's out in video and it's just...
I think it's a little, like 6 or 7 years ago.
Yes, yeah. I just loved it. But you have to be callous to that word.
Yeah, well, especially with Richard Pryor.
A couple other good ones that are on video, that word didn't make it big in the theater. One's called Mask, and Cher is in it. Oh, yeah.
That is
and
great.
And her son has a facial deformity, and how they and they're part of a motorcycle gang. Mm-hmm. And how this culture that most of us are not familiar with, these motorcycle people take in this deformed young man and embrace him and care for him. That one, and then Dominic and Eugene are two brothers. In fact, I'm not sure they're twins, but they're brothers. And one is the Jesus figure for the other in life. I mean, he takes his place. He took the place of an abusive father. He stepped between the abusive father and the brother, and didn't really know this all his life. And in the end, tries to say, "Oh, the child is being abused." It's just a beautiful Jesus figure in this life. It's Dominic and Eugene.
Didn't the persecution of overt Christianity bother you in that? If I had to name 10 films in which I thought Christianity was really being persecuted, that would be one of them. And we were just sitting here trying to think of the name of that film just a little while ago.
I didn't even notice it. Must not have bothered you.
Which one was it?
The crucifix on the wall and... The allusions to Christianity as being, you know, the opiate of the masses and that kind of a thing. I was really offended by that.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but the movie that really moved me was Fried Green Tomato.
Oh, yeah.
And the intensity of relationships in there, both intergenerational, women, among cultural diversity, and I thought with a group of women, and we just yacked about that and forgot that word.
That film did pretty well, didn't it, John?
Yeah, it did. It did real well.
Now why, you know...
In fact, most of these did.
Yeah, and... I mean, why can't they sort of set the standard? I mean, why all this other stuff?
I think because it's too easy not to. I think it takes some work to make movies.
It takes work to do a fried green tomato.
Yeah, it takes some thinking. You can either say, let's put some guns in it, or we can say, how do we include the sacred in our script? I think it's just more work.
Well, and you also have to take the time to develop character. And there are so many movies just go from one action to another action to another action, or have beautiful cinematography but have absolutely no character development. No. I mean, that requires really good script writing. It requires time also. Requires sustained attention,
right.
Which is a rare commodity these days. We're training people not to have sustained attention.
Yeah, they want fast action, and that's why chases and driving.
Well, I think there's a lot of people in Hollywood that aren't trying real hard to.
I mean, they do have the formula, and they figure they can just make films and make money by doing that.
But some of these are breaking through and getting their movies made.
Steel Magnolias is a movie that touched me greatly as a mom, as a friend, because the friendship and the closeness of those guys in there.
That community.
Mm-hmm.
I think Witness, by getting into each other's cultural diversity, this Philadelphia cop coming into the Amish community ended up coming into a big train station in the city. But I would imagine most people, including my town in Salem, saw that one.
How about the man from Snowy River?
There's another film movie that I can't think of a lot of examples of, but movies about different religions coming into contact and usually misunderstanding each other. And I'm thinking of Passage to India, but also, have you seen The Black Robe?
Yeah.
It's about the contact of Native American cultures and Jesuit missionaries in the 17th century. And for example, there's one scene where an Indian shaman is performing a ritual, and you see the Catholic characters going, oh, primitive, superstitious, devil worship. And then you're sort of looking at this Native American practice through European eyes, and you don't really understand it, so it seems pretty barbaric. And then suddenly the scene shifts to several years earlier in France, and here's this devout Catholic monk with his cross, and going through his rituals, which are in fact very similar. And you suddenly think, well, no, are they really all that different? And I just had this really deep sense of two different cultures trying to understand something beyond them, and each refusing to recognize the validity of any other religion or perception of the divine outside their own. I don't think these films like that, but there's something really, it's sort of what Luke was saying about trying to understand the world from another perception, from another culture, combined with, maybe that's related to, getting outside your own. I think there are also a lot of very profound films that are very critical and negative of Christianity. And that may be an important moment of self-criticism, self-transcendence for Christians to be able to realize the destructiveness of their own. Symbols and practices, and I don't know what, it doesn't make you feel real good a lot of times to see that, but there's something religious going on often.